episode 46, Sports Psychology, Part 1.
Welcome to the Oxidative Potential Podcast, where we discuss all things sports science and performance. I'm your host, Matthew DeRoche, and with me is my fellow co-host, Phil Batterson. Enjoy.
Good day, folks. First and foremost, I wanted to give a quick apology for missing uploads last week. Here on Prince Edward Island in Canada, the east coast of Canada, we got hit by a pretty big hurricane, which was ended up being the biggest hurricane that's ever crossed Prince Edward Island, the province here. So, or at least that we've recorded or been aware of in our history. So we were out of power for a week. It was really complicated. There was no childcare, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of damage done throughout the island. So it was a pretty big thing. And unfortunately, I couldn't get to editing and uploading the podcast. It was really difficult. Service was down on cell towers as well for quite some time for certain areas. Not all areas, but yeah, so sorry about that. But on today's episode, Phil and I will be discussing sports psychology. One thing to keep in mind in this episode, we didn't really get to have the full conversation, so this is going to be a two-parter. So you'll hear us talk about some stuff and understand that there's a context behind it. Like when we talk about negative self-talk, positive self-talk, there's definitely a context surrounding both those things in certain sports. There's more applicability versus other sports, I think. And also there's so many dependent factors on the individual. So understanding it's not just a blanket statement saying, hey, this one works, this one doesn't work, or this one can work well for people. It's always context dependent. So hope you guys enjoy this episode. Like I said, we'll be following up with a second episode. We laid out some of the interventions, how they're approached in most cases, and some of their benefits and kind of clarified on a lot of those things. So hope you guys enjoy it. We'll catch you later. Okay. So welcome back, folks. I like the way that Phil says that. So I'm going to start using it too.
Just
makes
back,
me feel,
folks.
Yeah, it makes me feel at home. Yeah. So today we are going to discuss all things sports psychology. Obviously we can't discuss all things, but we're going to try and dig in a little bit, talk a little bit about a review that does a good job in explaining stress management tools, but also like, what are we talking about when we're talking about sports psychology? I had a good experience, and actually there was a couple of university courses that I found quite interesting. And one of the reasons why was because when I took sports psychology in university, the professor was actually a practicing sports psychologist for the Montreal Canadiens at the same time. So we were getting a lot of theoretical background and understanding and applications to those things. But the experiences of someone that spent such a long time in the field is really invaluable in hearing how some of this stuff plays out, because sports psychology is a very theoretical landscape. So having that experience and understanding when things are applicable, the applications of sports psychology is really useful.
Yeah. And who it works for, who it doesn't work for.
Exactly.
I was just telling Matt this off air, but this is something that I have not really spent a lot of time thinking about. And a lot of like psychology research is very different from the research that I do. I do more of like the, let's do an exercise intervention than see what biochemical markers are changing. So just even the way that people in psychology talk about their research, right, is just a little bit different than the way we talk about. So yeah. It's not to say like one's better or not. It's just for me, a foreign language in a sense. So I'm going to be leaning pretty heavily on you, Matt, for the explanations and everything, but it is a very interesting topic where you need to both have like the theory behind it, but then the application. And that's cool that you had a professor that was working for the Montreal Canadiens like at the same time.
Yeah, Scotty, really great guy. I'll not get into the. I had the most embarrassing experience of my life in that class. I'll talk about it someday, but it's so funny that it happened in that class when we're doing like a sports psychology intervention.
Yeah, talking about just, like stress management and like other things like that.
Yes. And I literally think about it like once a month. I'm like, oh, God, let's just
say, oh, that was so embarrassing.
So embarrassing. Of course, it happened there in front of everyone. But so let's lay out what is a lot of sports psychology based around. And one of the main themes throughout a lot of sports psychology is stress management, but also the what is called the four pillars of self-efficacy. So with self-efficacy, it's built up into these components, one being mastery experiences, one being vicarious experience, one being verbal persuasion, and one being your psychological and emotional state. So essentially, these four things all complete this model of how does someone move through their sporting experience with self-efficacy and confidence to do that. So let's just talk about these briefly here. So mastery experiences would be essentially, what have you experienced in your sport that has proven to you that you're competent, right? What are these competent experiences that you've exposed yourself to over the years? Because this really does build a backbone for how you view yourself and how you view your abilities. If you've never really accomplished anything other than running 400 meters for a warm-up, for you to go out and run an ultra marathon or a marathon, it's going to be really hard for you to draw on those mastery right. experiences right. of where you've shown competency. Fairly simple, I think most people
yeah. Well, this is that. Like as an example, it's like once you say complete an Ironman or something like that, like this is something like I'm going to try to just like relate yeah. my life experiences to all this stuff since it is so new to me. But like once I completed an Ironman, I was like, oh, like I can complete an Ironman. Like that was 12 and a half hours of work. Is mm-hmm. so mentally it gave me the shift of like, I can do it. So if there is anything, if I really wanted to sign up for something that was like a crazy ultra marathon or anything like that, it's like, if it's within 12 and a half hours, yeah, I've done it before. I could probably do it again.
Yeah. And that's super useful just in everyday life, trying to show people or expose people to experiences that you know are going to develop a deep confidence. Like with my mother, for example, she always looked at people that ran marathons and even half marathons as these like amazing people. How can they do such a thing? Like, this is so impressive. And I wanted to show her that you can do the same thing. And whenever she went through that experience of training and competing for it, it literally, you could just see the confidence and true deep confidence brimming out. It was so deeply connected in her brain of, wow, what these people do is amazing. And when you actually actualize that. So moving into vicarious experiences, is this is a super important one. And the kind of main key example that's used a lot of the time is the Bannister 4-minute mile, right? Once that 4-minute mile was broken, how many people proceeded to break that 4-minute mile barrier over and over the next preceding decade, right?
Yeah, it was crazy. Like nobody had done it up until the point he did it. And then it was like, it was tens of people. Like,
yeah.
40, yeah. 50 people did it in the next year. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it was a lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a huge aspect. If no one else, and this is why I hold certain feats as really impressive, because certain people, like I just had a podcast with Mike McKnight that hasn't been aired yet, but he went out and ran 100 miles on zero calories, completely fasted. Easy. And I considered that one of the most amazing endurance feats ever done, because one, it's running 100 miles. It's impressive just to begin with. But two, he did something that no one else had ever really done before. He ran it, I want to say sub 18 hours. So that was super impressive to me. That's a super, super impressive feat, because he didn't really have any vicarious experiences to draw on.
Yeah.
Unless he's talking about these explorers that have been caught in various situations. And I think people can draw from some of those experiences and try to extrapolate. But if you don't have anything directly to relate to, it makes things much more resistant.
Yeah. I mean, that's like another application or relationship sort of thing. So for many of you, I don't think you know this, but I built like four campers on the back of my truck. Just like, I have a degree in mechanical engineering. I just like tinkering with stuff. Mm-hmm. And when I first got into it, I was like, oh man, this is super hard. Like, I didn't know what to like Google or YouTube or whatever it is. So my first build was like out of wood and plywood and learned a lot from it. But it was like that mastery thing, teaching myself mm-hmm. how to actually build a camper. And then mm-hmm. I was like, oh, well, would it be possible to actually like build a camper out of material, like industrial materials with no welding? And I found a number of people on YouTube who had been pretty much doing that. So mm-hmm. like that gave me the confidence to at least start the type of build that I wanted to do. And now I've built my own. So now hopefully the YouTube videos and all of that that I'm making online are the vicarious experience people need to be encouraged to then build their own camper. And this is obviously like a different aspect of life, but I think psychology is really cool in that sense, because you can apply it to sports, you can apply it to your job, you can apply it to your family, you can apply it to like every aspect of your life. So
yeah. It is massive. No matter what you do in life, seeing someone else out there that's walking the same path makes mm-hmm. things much less resistant. So moving into the next aspect of self-efficacy is verbal persuasion. So how do people speak about you? How do people encourage you, discourage you? This is something I've been dealing with lately a lot, and hearing how certain athletes talk about each other in relation to their upcoming events, right? How do these athletes describe one another and their various strengths and weaknesses? And this is a very important aspect of how people view themselves and how people walk into an event with confidence. If you talk to your coach about competing, possibly doing the 5K as your next kind of primary event, and he says, those shorter distances could work well with you. I think possibly if you shift some things, that's not going to leave you with a bunch of confidence. That's just not going to like have you think that this is a smart move. This is something that I'm going to ever be good at. So, you know, not only coaches, but also those little remarks that some people might make about you, like, oh yeah, Dave's a machine when it comes to taking corners. Like, no one corners like Dave. Mm-hmm. There's not a person on this planet I see go in with the drive and intensity into those corners. Those things leave a huge lasting mark. And in certain sports, they're much less referred to than other sports, like especially some of the sports that I came up with. If you ever heard your name attached to a compliment, that would stick in your head for the rest of your life, because they didn't really come around too often. Yep. So if a coach or a training partner ever said anything good about you, a lot of the times it would end up changing your game, because you're like, oh my goodness, I never even really thought I was that good at that thing, but these people think I am. And then you really start to hone in on some of those aspects of your game. And that's an important thing for thinking about. Hey, when you're working with people, you want to raise the whole. When you raise the whole, it raises everyone around you. And those environments where everyone is, the morale is high and people are driven and motivated, that will benefit everyone, including yourself.
Yeah.
So out of your way to make those kind of side notes and compliments are huge. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, and that's probably why we start to see, like, say for instance, in CrossFit, a lot of camps are starting to develop, and we're seeing, at least from the outside, that a lot of these camps have like people who are motivated, people who are ready to go, up and comers are tending to be like the more successful ones. Whereas like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to name names or anything like that, but there's definitely a few camps where you see that the coach is a little bit of a dick, like other things like that. And it's like, they're like bleeding athletes. Like the athletes don't want to be in that environment. And the great thing about being a professional athlete is you can choose your coach. It's not like, it's not like high school sports or whatever it is where it's like, you can't really choose. But yeah, I mean, that's, I think if you're thinking something positive when you're like working with somebody, just say it. Like you don't like we were talking off air about this too, is like, you don't know what somebody else is going through. So maybe just hearing that positive, like affirmation or something like that is what takes them from here and elevates them to the next level to give them the confidence that they need in order to really be successful at something. Like, for example, my fiance is amazing with dogs. And when I first met her, like one of the things that I first noticed was how good she was with like training her dogs and how well behaved they were. And I was like telling her that, and she was like, oh, you're just blowing smoke. Like, I'm just okay at training dogs, like other things like that. Cause like nobody had really told her, but then I told her, and then sure enough, she was like, and then we got to talking and she's like, oh, it'd be sweet to start a dog training business. And then as soon as she did that, like all of her family was like, yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, you're so good at training dogs and you're so patient and like so well thought out with like how you interact with these animals. It's like, it makes sense that you want to start this business. And now she went from like, oh, like I'm not that good to like, she's freaking crushing it. Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, again, application from sport to life, most of the time, negative comments, especially with people who are pretty sensitive to that, like, criticism and feedback isn't going to help elevate the group. It's just going to make people feel animosity and a little bit of a disappointment and stuff.
I totally agree. And there's environments where the psychology is different based on the culture and what kind of task is required, and sometimes it can work very well. But I can't state the importance of this enough. I'll never forget. There's one kid too that I'll never forget. This kid that came up to me and he's like, I know you don't remember, but you came up to me one day. I was getting picked on and you told me some really nice things about how I carried myself and to keep my head high and this, and it completely changed his life. He's like, ever since that day, I started walking with more confidence. I started working out. And that comment, that one comment that you said to me literally changed the trajectory.
Yeah.
And then he was doing a bunch of stuff at that time. And I was just, and there's been so many things like that. And I'm not good at giving compliments. You'll hear me kind of state, even on the podcast, someone pointed out the other day that I say like, good, I liked your answer or stuff like that. Like, part of me, I grew up from a culture where it's like, it's really dog eat dog. Yeah, like tearing the person down almost beside you. It's so competitive. So I've really had to come around and really change the way that I approach things, because it was like, we're not going to focus on what you're good on. I don't care about what you're good on. This is kind of the mindset. Like, if you want to get better, we don't focus on what you're good on. You never need to be told that. It's what do you need to change? What do you need to improve? Yeah. That's what we're focusing on. And that was the mindset that I came up through. So you never heard a compliment. And that can work well for some individuals. Or it's just like dogs, right? Mm-hmm. Some dogs don't want to be petted. Some dogs don't want, they're just like, unless you're going to throw the ball for me, or unless we're going to play tug, get out of my face. My dog is like that probably 95% of the time. Like, you go to pet him, he's like, no. Okay.
He's like, I'm good. Grabs the ball.
Yeah. He's like, he grabs the ball. He's like, if you want to show me affection, let's play a catch. Like, I don't care about your stupid pets. I want physical interaction type of thing with the ball. But yeah, so it's similar to people. So yeah. And how you talk to yourself as well sometimes can really play deep into that. So this is going to get into kind of our next and last pillar, is emotional and physiological states. So how do you currently feel? How do you currently hold yourself in terms of emotional state? How do you physically feel, right? If you're coming back from an ACL injury and you're having some coordination issues in your quadriceps and hamstrings, and you don't really feel like your timing is on point, you feel things are a little bit awkward and discoordinated, or maybe you're going through a slight depression over the loss of a family member, or maybe through an event that went in a training cycle that went really poorly and you got overtrained and things didn't go the way. Like, there's a lot of different things that are going to affect the perception of yourself, and emotional and physiological states, I think most people can understand, is part of that. And you see this all the time. I'm sorry, I'm going to talk about fighting here for a second, but people's self-efficacy change as the fight goes on, right? Mm-hmm. As some individuals get more tired and that CO2 starts to build up and that fatigue starts to set in, their perception of their abilities starts to change and their confidence starts to change. And it's not the same kind of slope for everyone. So this is a factor which we really try to hone in on with some of these stress management tools. And some of these other tools are more self-explanatory and even in their title, but these ones, they drive a lot deeper.
Yeah.
So we're going to dig into some of this stuff
too. But before you dig into that, here's an example. You have, so one of my buddies is like probably the strongest most competitive people I've ever met in my life. And but he absolutely hates like aerobic workouts, especially running. So it's like, even during the warm up, you can see that confidence or that swagger that he walks into the gym with just like totally shift. Like he hates running. And even if you do a 200 meter warm up, he's just like, you can just see it in his form and all of that. And you're just like, yeah, this is going to be a rough workout for him. Whereas like, and then, so it's definitely, it's like you can have like kind of those acute physical state changes that then lead to emotional state changes and other things like that. For me, I don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast, but I have a torn labrum in my right hip and it's been giving me a lot of like lower back, like it's not a lot of pain, but it's just enough pain to be like, oh, I didn't really sleep well last night because it was tweaked or something like that. Or like I've been sitting all day, so my hip flexor is all messed up. My glute med is all messed up, all of that. And it definitely plays a role on how well I can focus, like how confident I am in terms of just like getting a task done and all of that. So all things to just be aware of for sure, because everything within your environment plays, if you want to believe it or not, it plays a role in affecting how you perceive the environment and then how you react to that environment as well.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. I think, and there's more room in this area for sports psychology to affect performance, I think, than any other of the four pillars that I talked about, but they all kind of mesh in together. Mm-hmm. Like that's the thing about sports psychology is like, we look at it as a separate thing, but it's really intertwined into the physiology. And whether we're talking about cognitive psychology, ecological psychology, whatever kind of place you come from, and physiology, biology, like all these things are really so interconnected. Mm. Everything's connected, man. It's all one part of the universe. But I really can't state that enough. So whenever we talk about certain things, it's not really like, even though we're talking about it in isolation, it's never really in isolation because they're affecting multiple different applications. So this is what we're going to work off of in terms of a review, because there's not a ton of huge reviews out there in sports psychology that are actually done fairly rigorously. Because one of the things with psychology research is if there's no benefit or there's essentially null findings, a lot of that stuff just doesn't get published.
Yeah.
And
like a lot also, of research.
Yeah. 110%.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things too, you have to understand, are done through questionnaires and self-reporting. So, you know, the practical applications and the practical experience is super, super important in understanding that, like, for example, one of the things that we're going to talk about today is self-hypnosis. Hypnosis, if you look at how people can essentially enter a state of somnambulism or enter a state of hypnosis, that is very dependent from individual to individual. And the capabilities for an individual to essentially experience hypnosis is on a scale. So when we're talking about scales, this is something that is applicable to all sports psychology. And the groups that you're going to be intervening with, there's always going to be some amount of bias there. There's always going to be some amount of genetic bias. So we have to take all these things into consideration when we're looking at study design, when we're looking at how these studies are evaluated, the statistical applications. So what I'm trying to say is it's a very interesting field of research, but also understand that a lot of the stuff that is research and has maybe moderate to maybe smaller effect sizes, don't throw that stuff out the window, because that stuff might work really well for you. And meanwhile, 85% of the population, it's absolute trash, has no value to them. And also the way that people, you know, just because something doesn't work whenever you're 23 doesn't mean it's not going to work whenever you're 35 and you have different life experiences and you have different ability to use your faculty. So what is some of these studies essentially entailing? What are some of the methods of sports psychology interventions that they're talking about? So one of the big ones is cognitive interventions. So treatments of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is essentially dissecting the way that people think and process information and trying to manipulate some of those things so that the information that they're taking in is actually perceived differently.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually did. I was so like my experience with like psychology work and stuff has been mainly as more kind of self-help throughout my PhD, because it's like doing a PhD, especially when there's like year-long lockdowns and all that sort of stuff, can get a bit stressful. So like for me, I finally turned to trying to talk to somebody about it. And we did a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy, and it really is a, how do you shift the way that you perceive things? And like, for example, when I was first starting my PhD, my mindset was I need to get perfect sleep every single night, because if I get perfect sleep, then I'll be in the highest possible cognitive state to be able to support my ability to write, to research, to do those sort of things. And then with talking to my therapist and stuff, he's like, well, what happens if you don't get a good night of sleep? Does that actually ruin your ability to think the next day and all of that? And it's like, there were some nights and he was just like, just try it, because it's just one day. It's what we talk about with like exercise training interventions. It's like, just try it for a little bit. If it doesn't work, you can just go back to what you were doing. Yeah. Then with all of like, so then I would like give myself a little bit of leeway, not really think about like how well I slept. And turns out, that's actually a lot healthier than being so regimented and so strict about your sleep routine that like, if any little thing messes it up, you're like, well, my sleep was ruined. Because then you start the day with like I didn't sleep well. And then you just give yourself like excuses in a sense to be like, oh, well, that's why I'm not doing this well today or something like that. So I think that's a pretty powerful tool just to shift your mindset and just, like, especially if you're the type of person who's like very high stress, very high anxiety, it could be useful.
Yeah. I think a very useful kind of frame of mind to adopt for health, longevity, and resilience is the kind of the anti-fragile. Like, you're educated. It doesn't mean like you go out and like, oh, pesticides won't hurt me, I'll just go drink this gallon of pesticides, it's just going to make me stronger. Understanding the dose response curve of hormesis, but also understanding that humans are very adaptive and resilient creatures, and taking the mindset, even if I do get exposed to some of these things, or maybe nerve agents of spraying your home or whatever it is, like you got, it's like, oh, it's, you can sit there and say, oh, my kid's going to grow up with learning disabilities and blah, 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 blah. Right. All the stress that you take on, rather than just looking at it and being like, humans are resilient. There's ways to approach some of these things other than just stressing. There's actually things that you can do to try and limit the effects of those things. And it's realistically, it's a low dose exposure and I'm probably going to be fine. And it's the same thing with sleep. There's been plenty of studies out there showing how people perceive their sleep is a huge factor of how they perform in that day moving forward. Also, another one, coping, another thing, goal setting, hypnosis is another thing they talk about in here, imagery, rationale, emotive therapy, and self-talk. So these kind of fall in the cognitive interventions. And essentially what they did was they summarized the studies. There's what they found was 23 positive effects, 6 null effects, and 1 negative effect for stress components and performance with these kind of modalities. So they bracket it in different levels too of competition. So when you move up different scales of competition, how do these things affect individuals differently? So yeah, these are all kind of components. So when people just say sports psychology and they just think imagery, it's like, well, yeah, imagery is one tool that may not work that well for you, but imagery. And also there's actually been some really cool studies on using imagery to improve performance in terms of something that people have zero exposure to. They get exposed to it, like throwing darts. They mentally rehearse the practice of throwing darts for several times a week for like 20 minutes. And their ability to throw darts improves almost just as much, or it can, and sometimes improve more than people that are actually practicing it if they're actually spending more time using mental imagery. And this is something that I've used over the years with tons of different sports, because I go through different phases of seasons and training and different things. And sometimes I don't have access to be able to do some of the things that I like to do. Whatever I'm trying to do for work or these things, I take these breaks of going through different movements, techniques, different aspects of sport where I mentally rehearse. And when I come back to those sports, it's, you know, it's always nice to see that the drop off is much less than what I thought it would be because I'm rehearsing. And also you can get better at things. For example, this is something that I used a lot in my fighting career was I would sit there and try to figure out, I would go through mental repetitions of how to figure out sequences or setting traps in fighting or sequences in jiu-jitsu. And I would come back to the mats much better than I'd ever been before. Yeah. Using those sequences because I've actually worked through them in my head found the coordination in my body to figure out how to get that right technique to be applied at the right time. So this is useful for people. Let's say you're doing a gait change or using whatever, some type of mental imagery for strategy that you're going to use in a race against certain individuals. This is all really good stuff.
That's goal something
setting is huge too. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, sorry to interrupt. I was going to say this is actually something that my cross country coach in high school did that I really liked is every Friday before our Saturday race, he would have us all lay down like on the football field. And then he would like talk us through the race. Mm. And it's like at first when you're a freshman, you're just like, I don't know what this course even looks like. But like, as you get more and more ingrained in the sport and you start to recognize, okay, well, we're going back to this same race that we've raced 4 years in a row, you can actually start to visualize it yourself. And you can be like, well, this would be a perfect place to kick. This would be a perfect place to make a move, other things like that. And then it gives you like that experience of like, oh, well, I've already run this course before in my head. Mm-hmm. So now I'm more confident because I know that there's going to be a big hill right here, or I know that this is going to occur. That's also something I do with like all of my engineering projects is like, before I even build anything, I build it probably 100 times in my mind. And I think that helps me like figure out like any flaws or issues or anything like that and how I could like best assemble something. So, and then another thing that I'm now going to try is like, I've been really into disc golf lately and I haven't done too many skill sports growing up. I was more just like, let's go run cross country and track. But I think that mentally practicing your throwing motion, like that's a pretty hard skill to master. But mentally practicing that throwing motion, once you actually get to it, as long as you're thinking about like the right way of actually throwing it and stuff, would be beneficial. So I'm going to give that a try actually.
Hugely beneficial. Yeah. I played a few skill sports. One of them when I was younger was golf. I used to play a lot of golf. I used to play like 100+ rounds a year of golf.
Wow.
So I spent a lot. That's like 400+ the driving range for several years. So probably 500+ hours on more, maybe 600 a year on the golf course. As the sport becomes more skill orientated in terms of coordination and these things, rather than, I mean, yes, the physical qualities and physiological qualities are always important, but for golf, it's very skill orientated. A lot of these psychological interventions become more important and more useful. And if you're not using imagery and you're trying to be a good golfer or skill sport, it's going to be tough. I'm like, most recreational people don't have to, obviously, but I'm saying like, if you're a golfer and your goal is to become a professional golfer and you're not using imagery or some sort of psychological intervention, you're definitely going to be at a disadvantage, I would say, for sure. And there's huge benefits for any type of skill sport with these interventions. Goal setting is another one.
Yes.
Goal setting is huge. How you set your goals. And one thing, folks, like, maybe you do this, maybe you don't. If you physically write it down, not on your phone, but on a piece of paper or on a whiteboard somewhere in your house, with you visually have to interact with that, changes your perception of what you're doing massively.
Yeah.
And like when you have to confront that physical space on the wall every day, that's going to change your perception of what you're doing. Most of us have gone through the process of goal setting somewhere in the back of our head, where it's nice and safe and we don't really have to confront it that much. We don't have to be held accountable.
Yeah.
And we procrastinate and we do these things. But the act of like the simple act of just writing it down and putting it somewhere visual, that's huge. And you can get a lot more elaborate with goal setting. There's a huge, whether you're using SMART goals or whatever it is, there's a huge aspect of goal setting driving success. There's not a lot of successful people I know that don't have at least some ability to set goals relatively well. Yeah. So another one, like we talked about earlier, hypnosis. Now, hypnosis is something you can probably tell I have a kind of fond fascination surrounding hypnosis, and I actually use hypnosis quite thoroughly. And a lot of people don't really understand a lot about hypnosis. So they either just skip.
Well, you just think it's like what a magician does. You
know, they think of it as
somebody to like quack when they say something.
Yeah.
It's so true. Inappropriate, but that's how I.
That's what a part of hypnosis is. It's like stage hypnosis has been around for a long time. It's been around for quite some time. But actually, the first use of hypnosis was used in medicine. And it was actually a very convoluted path. Mesmer, you go back to this is way back in the day. But they didn't really understand hypnosis. Mm-hmm. So it was called animal magnetism. And this is why, like, if you look at the background of it, it's really surreal, like thinking like how far we've come, where now it's being studied and it's being applied in some of the best universities in the world and the NIH and all this stuff. But so most people, like everyone listening here, has been hypnotized. People don't realize that. The definition of hypnosis, I'll use Alman's definition first, is a state of mind in which the critical faculty has been bypassed and selective thinking has been established or introduced. And if you look at kids, you'll notice kids are in a stage of hypnosis all the time. Like I see my daughter in the stage of hypnosis at least once or twice a day, where I'm like, either I'm pushing her on the swing or doing something, and I'm like talking to her, and she's just completely consumed by what she's doing, and she's being fed in by the experience.
Yeah.
That's a form of hypnosis. And there's different degrees of hypnosis. Go ahead.
So would you say like that hypnosis could also be like a meditative state? Is that?
Yeah. So a lot of people it's funny. You want to know what, Phil, is you're smart to come up with that, because anytime I hear a question asked, a lot of people ask a question of, is it similar to meditation? Mm-hmm. Really good thinkers, because they're like, oh man, there's a connection there. And it is in a lot of the ways, because hypnosis is essentially, it's an altered state of mind.
Yeah.
And you're essentially engaging in it with yourself. People think that you're being hypnotized by someone. No. It's all hypnosis is self-hypnosis.
Okay.
You're hypnotizing yourself. You're allowing yourself to get in the state of hypnosis, or even deeper into somnambulism, which is essentially a deeper state where suggestibility is extremely high. So one of the ways I like to explain it to people a little bit more state of factly is essentially you're removing a lot of the defense mechanisms that your neurology likes to play. And when you remove those physical and mental defense mechanisms, your ability to resist suggestion goes down. And you'll never, and I know this sounds scary for people, but you're not going to be hypnotized to do something bad. Like people think like, oh, hypnotize me to go commit a crime. That's never happened. There's never been a documented case of that, because as soon as your brain realizes that this is not something that you want to engage in,
or is
you will
not
pull
safe.
Yourself at a hypno. Yeah, you will pull yourself, because there's always the survival mechanism. And your body intelligently and your brain intelligently knows when something is not going to be for your benefit. Mm-hmm. Hypnosis always works in this kind of scheme of like, even for stage hypnosis, there is a subconscious, because this is really getting interacted with your subconscious mind.
Yeah.
So the reason people are doing silly stuff on stage is because subconsciously they know it's providing an entertainment value.
It's not damaging them.
Right? And it's not damaging them. And some of those people that they don't use on stage that come up it's because they're like, oh no, this is not beneficial for me. They might be hypnotizable, but it's just, they're coming out of the state because it's not something that subconsciously, so you're working closer to your subconscious.
Yeah. I wonder if people who are less hypnotizable, in a sense, I don't know if that's a word, but
It is.
I wonder if people who are less susceptible to that are more of like the kind of like self-conscious, anxious, maybe a little bit more insecure, like your subconsciousness is always on high alert. Like, I don't think I would be very hypnotizable. In a sense, like I've tried meditation and all that other stuff, and it's really hard for me to even have my brain get to a point where it's like just like one thought at a time. It's always something's moving. So I wonder if that's one of the factors that kind of plays into it.
There is thoughts on that, but there's been a lot of research actually on what makes someone hypnotizable. What are the psychological characteristics? And there's really nothing that has a rather large effect size in terms of traits.
Yeah, there's nothing
that you can really pinpoint. But for example, when you talked about anxiety, that can be a factor. Some people, not everyone, like you could take two fills and they're like, they're resistant to that type of suggestibility and they like that type of like clear, straightforward path. One guy, because he might interact with the hypnosis differently, that fear won't limit him to go into hypnosis, because fear is a huge limiting factor of going into hypnosis, and anxiety and all these things are all intertwined, and it can prevent people from getting there. And that's what some of the great hypnotists out there really understood well, is how to remove those kind of overlying anxiousness feelings around it and bring about hypnosis in a way that's really subtle. And also in a way, I'm not going to get into, I'm already going too far, too deep into it now, but it's super fascinating. I'll probably do a podcast on this in the future surrounding sports performance, just performance in general, and any kind of aspect, because it is a useful tool for people that are relatively hypnotizable.
So
then imagery, self-talk is another thing. And I actually, this is funny, because I had a slight kind of back and forth with the WOD science guys, because they put forth positive self-talk is always going to improve performance, and like negative self-talk is always bad. And that's just not true. And I always believe that, and this is working to my bias, so I do have a bias surrounding this, because I know several people in several kind of different communities of people where positive self-talk doesn't work that well.
Yeah.
And I think people don't understand that there's a difference between the negative self-talk that is proposed a lot of times in the literature. And there's been research. And one thing that my professor pointed out to me was this, in fact, that there is a small minority out there that perform much better with kind of negative self-talk. And these people are usually hyper-competitive.
So I've been watching a lot of disc golf lately. That's my sport. That's my competition. And you watch the way that certain pros talk to themselves after they miss a putt. And it's like, there's definitely like negative self-talk and positive and negative, positive self-talk.
Yeah. I know,
like if that makes sense, where like, it's like, if you miss a putt, you're like, oh, dadgummit, like just totally miss it. You're a piece of shit. Like I was like, oh, can I swear on this podcast? Totally forgot. So it's like, you know, it's like, you're like demeaning yourself or whatever it is. But then there's other people that are just like, ah, dadgummit, missed that. You're like, I released it low. And if you say like, it's like, you can be mad at yourself for releasing it low, but calling yourself a piece of shit, that's not going to get you anywhere. It's like, how do you engage in that negative self-talk? Because if you're like, same with the positive self-talk, if you're just always telling yourself you're the best at everything, that's probably not beneficial. But if you're like, oh man, dude, you crushed that drive because you pulled through really nicely and you had a really nice snap on the disc. Like that's appropriate positive self-talk. So I think much like anything, right? It's like, it depends sort of situation, and the way that you engage in the talk is super important. From a PhD perspective, there's so many times where I'm talking to other PhD students and they're just like, oh, you know, I just can't do this. Like every time I get stuff back, like I just can't write well. It's like, I can't write well. It's like, well, or it's like, I'm working on getting better at telling a research story. There's two ways to phrase it. So I can definitely see why, like how it could go both ways.
Yeah. I'm one of the reasons I have this bias is because I'm one of those individuals where there is nothing that motivates me more than negative self-talk. And I've tested this on several types of, and it's really hard to test these things on yourself. I'll just state that clearly because there's an internal bias, but there's really nothing that motivates me more, especially when we're talking about endurance performance or incremental tests on treadmill, exhaustive tests on whatever type of modality, than negative self-talk. You are being weak right now. You're weak. You're weak. Yes. You're falling into your pity emotions. Look at you. It's pathetic.
Yeah.
It's really pathetic.
Yeah.
See, and when I hear myself stating that, I have so much fear of being that individual.
Yeah. That you're my like, ego no, I'm in. Not.
Exactly. And I'm hyper competitive. I play with this in many different, that was a very basic, I'm not going to get into my actual self-talk, but it goes pretty deep, but there is definitely individuals out there. It's the same with cornering an individual. I was just talking to a coach the other day and he's like, for fighting, for example, you have a win and a lose kind of purse, right? Like, so if you win, you're winning almost double a lot of the times of what you'd be winning is if you lose. You get paid to show up and pay to win. And some people, the framework, if you put like, look, this guy's literally going to take food off your table. How many times do you fight this year? How much of that's going to your manager? How much of that's going to your taxes, your coach? What are you left with? He's about to take half of that away from you. And some of these fighters, they're not making a lot of money in the very beginning. And even in the UFC, like when you actually look at when it's all stripped away, and some fighters, that really intrinsically motivates them. Whereas other fighters, you put that frame of reference to them, they're like, dude, don't say that to me. That messes me up. That doesn't help. Most coaches get a feel for people, know the types of individuals that, I'm not saying that's how you should approach it with athletes, but I'm just saying that's an example.
Yeah. On the flip side of things, for me, I deal with, like, I'm really good with positive internal self-talk, but a lot of that motivation comes from what I perceive as somebody like doubting me, like giving me negative, negative talk. Like, oh, you just like, you can't hack it. Like you could never do an Ironman. Like, I can watch me or like the number one thing to get me to do the opposite is to tell me I can't do something. Yeah. Or to like, yeah, to like actually do it, because like, you know, there's so many people too who have just been like, oh, well, 80% of businesses fail. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm probably in that 20. I am in that 20%. Like I'm going to make my businesses successful. And so that's the sort of thing that like then it's the negative out in or external thoughts or not thoughts, but like words that then give me the positive, the positive self-talk. So that's what works for me.
And there's another aspect of this I'll talk about briefly, and I can't remember the name of the paper exactly. I believe it's like Cultural Perspectives Effects on Self-Talk. And it went through, especially if you've ever been around people that were brought up in Korean culture, these are very tough cultures in terms of psychology, in terms of how they view themselves and competitiveness. Like they are very hyper-competitive people in certain ways, in certain aspects. And they notice that a lot of these high performers performed really well with actual just blatant negative self-talk. I'm not saying this is psychologically healthy, folks. This is just what was observed. So there is several different ways that people can use self-talk to have high performance, or in some people, pressure makes diamonds. Increasing that pressure and finding that optimal pressure. And some people, you have to push the pressure up. Some people, you have to tone it down. There's that bell curve of arousal where there's an optimum arousal, and self-talk manipulates that in a way too. So some people, you need to increase that pressure. Some people, you need to decrease that pressure. And what you say to them, like for me, that's why the kind of negative self-talk really works for me, is because when I show up to game day for a lot of things, I need to actually increase my arousal. I'm that dopamine kind of dominant neurotype where it's like, yes, feed me more for me to compete well. Some people, when they show up to game day, they're over aroused. And if you say you're worthless, that's just not going to feed. Yeah, exactly. So understanding the state of how these kind of self-talks affect arousal as well, because there's other parts of arousal and there's other kind of sports where like extreme sports, generally, everyone needs to bring down arousal, whether that's climbing, skydiving, extreme skiing, backcountry skiing, whatever it is, fighting. Generally, everyone needs to bring their arousal down for the most part in some ways, but still self-talk can affect that in various degrees. But yeah, so I mean, that was really long, complicated divergence, but let's see, we might even have to make this a two-parter. Because I mean, let's just kind of riff a little bit more on some of these things in the study, because I think there's two different categories left of some of the stuff that they use. And I think it'd be good to save those.
Okay.
Maybe for another podcast on it. And then we can maybe release it as one, or we can release it as a two-parter.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good to me.
But essentially, really understanding who you are and who your athlete is super important. So there's one thing that I use is some type of psychological traits assessment. There's several different ones out there that you can find. And really that's just going to depend on what type of language you want to use when you're looking at things and how your framework works around athletes and you work with yourself. The one I use a lot of the times is a Braverman test, not because I'm actually trying to measure neurotransmitters. It's just the framework that I like to look at in terms of how athletes respond to different types of kind of training interventions. And that was built off the model, like I've mentioned before, of actually some Russian research that I came across, which was essentially psychologically profiling wrestlers and showing that training different psychological profiles differently actually can improve the outcomes and even kind of performance measures as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's very important for individuals, whether it's yourself or if you're coaching, to understand who is in front of you. If it's yourself, yeah. Who are you? What are the things that deter you, and making those things known so you can address them?
Yeah.
Like if you just blatantly don't like doing resistance training, understanding that is you have a bias against that and it's not something you enjoy doing, learning how to work with that, or understanding that, like, when you show up to a race, your nerves are so high, so your digestion ends up going out the window, and understanding how long before that really starts to impair your digestion, all these things, kind of laying out all these things, not only just with your psychological profile, but how they affect different parts of your performance and your preparation.
Yeah.
Really important to know. And also really important to understand the kind of self-talk that you have with yourself or that you're having with your athletes. So I think that can't be really overstated enough, is like, how do you like to be spoken to? Really dig down and understand that.
Yeah. What drives you as well? Yeah. Like, where do you derive your motivation from? And this is something that kind of bugs me about some sort of things that I've done in the past, is like, a lot of people, I think they have in their mind what a perfect, say, athlete should look like, what a perfect, like, student should look like, what a perfect PhD student should look like, whatever it is. And mm-hmm. they get this in their head that's like, that avatar is probably who they are.
Yeah.
And, but there's so many different ways to get to a similar goal. For example, like within like my academic pursuits, I've always been told, like, you need to be intrinsically motivated for stuff. If you're not intrinsically motivated, then, you know, you're never going to be successful at this. And from some perspective, I disagree with that. I think that if you're a good coach, a good mentor, then you're willing to work with somebody who, for example, might need a little bit more extrinsic motivation to try to make goals that allow that extrinsic motivation, and then in combination with intrinsic motivation, to keep things moving and keep things going when things get rough. I think it's especially important to know who you are when things get challenging, because the only advocate for yourself is yourself. Yeah. And knowing better who you are, you can better voice what things you need in order to make you successful. I also think it's very much on the coach or the mentor side of things to try to understand who a person is, though, too. So like you were saying, by taking like that Braverman test, which I just pulled up and I'm going to take that at some point today. No. But I've done the Gallup Strengths Finder test. Have you ever done that before?
No.
It's pretty cool.
Reminded to me, I might have. But
yeah. Yeah. So the Gallup organization, I think it's just like a bunch of like testing and behavioral sort of science. But basically what they do is they give you a bunch of questions. And then from those questions, they can break down out of 34 different themes, like where your personality kinds of trends towards. So for example, my top five are relator, self-assurance, learner, competition, and where's the other one? And significance. Okay. So from that, it's like, and this is like, this was done in 2015, and it still is like just so spot on accurate to like what actually gives me purpose. So I really think the Gallup report or the Gallup Strengths Finder test is a really cool one. It's something I did back, like I said, 7 years ago now. Holy crap. Yeah,
I might have heard of that one, but I know I haven't done it. So
yeah,
that is an interesting one. I'm going to check that one out too. So.
Yeah, I think it's like 25 or 50 bucks or something like that, but it's certainly worth it. And then again, based on that, it's like one person isn't five descriptions. Based on that, you can really, if it does feel accurate to you, you can really get an idea of like what could potentially work.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're definitely going to do a two-parter to this.
Maybe you'll go do your test and then we can discuss it at the beginning.
Yeah, do a psychoanalysis here on the couch. So yeah, folks, if you want to find Phil, he's at Critical02 on Instagram, and I'm at ResilienceHPC on Instagram, and Oxidative Potential is the YouTube channel. I'm late uploading some of the videos for it, but I'll have them, the rest of them uploaded soon here. Nice. But yeah. So if you guys want to check us out there, questions, inquiries, consultation, inquiries, anything, yeah, just hit us up.
Yep.
And I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast. We'll be back soon.
Yep. Catch you in the next one.